5 minutes. We agree in this room on 5 minutes, so we will resume in 5 minutes.
Okay, staff has prepared 3 briefing memos for the board on the proposed groundwater and surface water usage, the second one on impacts to protected natural resources, and the third on the proposed seawater access system. There obviously are a number of the issues and licensing criteria that the applicant needs to address, but these were 3 of the major issue areas that staff felt it would be appropriate to provide some additional background information for the board on the actual evidence in the record and the relevant licensing criteria. And there are a significant number of staff members available here on the at the meeting to respond to make their presentations and to respond to questions board members may have. And we're going to be doing this in sections. So Ms. Callahan will be loading their PowerPoint presentation. And we want to, after each of the topic areas, pause there for board member questions and discussion. And so with that, I'm going to stop sharing my screen and turn it over to Ms. Callahan.
Morning, Estefany. This is Beth Callahan with the Bureau of Land Resources. Give me just one moment, and I will share my screen with you. All right, is that viewable by everybody?
Yes.
Great. I believe we are ready to begin, and Dawn Hollowell will be taking over.
Good morning, board members. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. my name is Dawn Hollowell, and I'm the Regional Licensing and Compliance Manager for the Bureau of Land Resources. I'm here to briefly introduce the topic of water use. You have our prepared memo. Today, you'll also hear from Dylan Schultz. He's going to present on the proposed natural resource impacts, and Beth Callahan will present some information on the proposed seawater access system. You'll also hear, or present with us, is Dr. John Hopek, Kevin Martin, and Nick Livesey. They're here to help answer any questions you have. Before I really get started, I just want to point out a couple of errors in the water use memo that you have before you. The first one was an error in the anticipated amount of fresh water use. The memo says 1,000 gallons per minute, and it is 1,205 gallons per minute. And the second error is the seawater intake pipe will be elevated 12 inches off the substrate, not 10 feet. So I apologize for those errors. Hopefully they didn't throw you for a loop there. Okay, now let's see if I can move the screen. There we go. Here's the list of the regulatory criteria that's applicable to the proposed water use project, water use portion of the project. As Cindy had stated in her memo, in her brief introduction today, Nordic does propose to withdraw both freshwater and seawater for the project. The freshwater withdrawal will be a combination of on-site groundwater wells, surface water from the Little River, and public water from the Belfast Water District. And seawater would be withdrawn from an intake pipe embedded in Belfast Bay. The anticipated water use is 1,205 gallons per minute of freshwater and 3,925 gallons per minute of seawater. The freshwater use would consist of groundwater withdrawal from 3 on-site production wells for a total of 455 gallons per minute. The surface water withdrawal from Belfast Reservoir number 1, otherwise known as the lower reservoir, is 70 gallons per minute plus inflows for a maximum of 250 gallons per minute. And the Belfast Water District will supply 500 gallons per minute of drinking water to the facility. The water supplied by the Belfast Water District would primarily be used for domestic use and fish processing, and seawater would be drawn through two proposed intake pipes located approximately 6,400 feet from the shore. The interveners did raise several concerns regarding the overall water use for the project, including saltwater intrusion, the competency of both the upper and the lower dams, contingency plans, should there be an adverse impact to groundwater and wells, groundwater recharge, the overall size of the facility, and climate change. Rob Moeller, who's a senior environmental engineer with the Division of Environmental Assessment, reviewed the proposed water withdrawal from the Little River and commented that it has been designed to meet the Chapter 587 rules. The other expert we have reviewing for the proposal for the department is Dr. John Hopek. He's our senior geologist. And Dr. Hopek reviewed the proposed project and recommended that baseline data regarding surface water flows, groundwater levels, and quality from both on-site and off-site wells be collected during the construction of the project. He also recommended that the applicant consult with the department to finalize a monitoring plan for the Little River and its aquifer. He indicated that it should include the flow of the Little River, an on-site weather station, on-site and off-site groundwater wells, the monitoring of wetland 7 and shallow groundwater in its vicinity, warning levels and remedial actions also need to be included in the monitoring plan. Nordic has an agreement with the Belfast Water District to purchase 500 gallons per minute or 720,000 gallons per day. And that water would be pulled from the Goose River Aquifer using the district's existing infrastructure. The agreement requires Nordic to purchase a minimum of 100 million gallons per year or make a payment in lieu of that purchase. In support of that, the applicant submitted a 2018 AE Hodgson report that recommended that the district bring on one additional well known as the Talbot Well. The Talbot Well is currently in place, but not operational. This well would need to be brought online to meet the demands of the project. During his review, Dr. Hopek asked for information regarding the flow of the Goose River and the water levels of the aquifer, which has not been submitted to date. Nordic did submit a copy of a docket number 2018-43 from the Public Utility Commission, which did two things. The Public Utilities Commission approved the sale of land from the Water District to Nordic, and it approved the water supply and purchase agreement between the Water District and Nordic. In this docket, the Public Utilities Commission indicated that the Water District does have the capacity to serve Nordic, as well as continue to serve its existing customers. The PUC did not discuss potential environmental impacts in its decision. In his review comments, Dr. Hopek recommended that a monitoring plan be established for the Goose River and its aquifer. This monitoring plan should be structured similar to the Little River monitoring plan. As a result of the reviews, and if the board were to approve the project, staff have included three potential conditions for your consideration. They're more fully described in the memo, but just briefly, the first is to refine the proposed water resources monitoring plan for the Little River and its aquifer. The second is to require the collection of baseline data during the construction phase of the project. And the third might be to, because the potential effects of the pumping of the Talbot Well are unknown, the applicant should define and implement a water resources monitoring plan for the Goose River and its aquifer. And it's recommended that this monitoring plan be structured similarly to that of the Little River. That concludes my basic presentation, and both Dr. Hopek and I are available for questions.
So I will I guess if we can take the slide down, there we go, and return everybody here. And first of all, before we start, Mr. Draper, would you be kind enough to introduce yourself?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Desane. My name's Mark Draper. I'm the Solid Waste Director for Aroostook Waste Solutions in Fort Fairfield, and I reside in Caribou.
Judging by the microphones that are unmuted at the moment, Ms. Lessard and Mr. Sanford seem to be prepared with questions, and I will go Mr. Sanford first.
Hey, the Talbot well, it's in place, but it's not operational?
Yes, that seems to be what the 2018 AE Hudson report indicates, that it's in place, but they do not currently draw from that well.
Is it capable of being operational?
Yes,
okay.
It is.
Thank you.
Ms. Lessard.
Yes, okay. The memo indicates on page 17 that information had been requested, but still had not been received in regard to the Goose River aquifer. Did you anticipate that you would have received that now? Is that because that's not the same condition as what's recommended at the end of the memo?
If we had received that information, we would perhaps not be asking for that recommendation or making a suggestion that the board consider asking for that monitoring plan. So we just don't have and Dr. Hopek, if you're on the line, feel free to jump in and help me, but it's my understanding that we don't have all of the necessary information that we need to fully understand what might be going on in that system.
Well, that's correct. The 2018 report identified, referred to several sources of information. It referred to areas where data had been collected. And so referring back to the memo that we sent them in September, we requested that information to determine what the possible impact on flows would be. The report does explicitly state that use of the Talbot well will induce flow from the Goose River, and that was the source of the reason behind our question as to what the sources of data were, how they had been collected, whether they were useful for our purposes, and we requested that information and have not received it as of yet.
So just to clarify, I think what I'm hearing is that it's not possible to assess impact unless you have information related to that topic for the Talbot Well Goose River piece of this application.
I would say that's correct, yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Draper, you appear to have a question?
Yeah, a couple. Thank you. First one is related to this monitoring plan that's to be submitted for the Little River watershed. And so this is a question, and perhaps a suggestion is, would that monitoring plan also include some sort of contingency plan that would prescribe certain steps that would need to be taken if certain conditions were being observed? You know, and I'm primarily thinking about, you know, private drinking water or residential drinking water wells that would be in the neighborhood. You know, if they should start seeing impacts, what are we going to do? It's one thing to see the impacts or the trends. It's another to actually do something about it. Would that plan include something like that? And if not, should it?
I think that if we go back to the two memos that we sent them in September and January, we sort of spelled out that process, that what we would want to see is a phase of background information to just focus on the domestic wells as an example, to find out what sort of normal range of operation and range of water levels in those. Domestic wells are obviously in use, so they're subject to significant changes or possibly significant changes in water level over the course of time. So we want to get what is that bracket in there, and how does that water quality change over time, over the course of the year, so that based on that, we can define or have the applicant, we'd be able to have the applicant define if this is the normal range of operation, if we see a deflection from that by this much, given what the water level is, what the setting of the pump is, how much the house tends to use, it's still safe, but it's a point where we would raise concern, and that would be what we might call an alert level. So we want to know, we want to define where that is, and then we want to say, okay, that triggers the following action. So that if it stabilizes at that new level, maybe that's okay. If it continues to what would be an action level, or we call an action level, which would be, again, still the individual, the homeowner still has usable water, but we're clearly at a point where that is threatened, then there would be a set of actions spelled out. Okay, we are here, the applicant is following things, which would be provision of an alternate water supply, provision of water treatment, connection to public water, reduction of water use in one or more on-site wells, whatever is the most appropriate thing. So the idea that would be written into the plan, so that if we get to that point, we're not discussing what the options are. We know what happens at that point, but we start looking at that at some level well before the impact takes place. And the path that we have laid out in the memos and in the proposed condition would be to do that for the domestic wells, for the sort of perimeter sentinel wells, to look at conductivity, to look at flows in the Little River and the Goose River, to look at the range of water levels and potentially impacted wetlands. So to sort of set that up for all the resources on site and off site that could potentially be impacted by the development.
Okay. Thank you,
Mr. Draper.
Yeah, my second question is, from looking at the freshwater sources, from an environmental perspective, is there any preferential hierarchy to using surface water over the production wells on the site versus the water from the Belfast Water District? In other words, there may be some from a business perspective from the applicant, but is there from an environmental perspective is there any preference to use one over the other?
I would say that there might be, and that's something that would certainly be built in as an option for the applicant that we could build into the sort of a response plan, if you will, if you're seeing impacts due to on-site groundwater pumping, but they may only be using much less than their allotment from the water district. One of the solutions could be to use more of that allotment from the water district and reduce the on-site groundwater or freshwater until we determine more comprehensively what a suitable level of withdrawal from the wells or indoor surface water would be. So that would be an option. And to some extent, as I think we heard at the hearing, they also have some options with how much seawater they can use versus fresh water. Right? So that adjusting that balance, would certainly, in the simplest case, if we were seeing saltwater intrusion and unacceptable water levels in on-site wells, we would have, we would say, reduce the groundwater usage until water levels in these wells reach this elevation. And it's up to you whether you take that additional water from freshwater or from the water district. But what has to happen is that reduction in pumping until we see restoration of the water levels in those domestic wells.
Thank you.
I see Mr. Parker and Mr. Pelletier in the queue, and I'll go to Mr. Parker.
Yes, I've got sort of a follow-up to one that Mark just had, then I've got another question altogether. Is my understanding is if you use water from the water district and growing out the smolt and stuff rather than processed water and domestic usage water, then they're going to have to go to some kind of a dechlorination treatment facility to prepare the brew of the Belfast water so they can use it. Whereas if they get their own water, they can use ozone or ultraviolet or something that's not obtrusive to the fish. And the brew water, the Belfast Water District has no option but to put chlorine in the water under the statutes they have to operate under. So that may be a reason that they are preferring not to use that for some of the smoke grow out and whatever. That's my comment. Now, my question was, if you look back at this information, it says that the Goose River Aquifer is being operated in compliance with Chapter 587. They had a study done back in 2018 by A.E. Hodson, an engineer, that said that they have the capacity to put another groundwater well in, and they may have to expand that as their service grows. I can see why the water district is not quick to fire information back, because I don't know if they want us coming in under this application and totally reanalyzing that whole water structure and water system. They have the capability to provide the water under their own auspices. They have to meet rules and regulations to do it. And I don't see how we could go up and require them to put do studies in addition to what they've done, because they made a purchase of a new site and moved to it specifically based on analysis that were done so they'd have water capacity available. That's my comment on that. That's all, Bob. I'm done.
Okay. Any response from staff on that, or should I go direct to Mr. Pelletier?
I would just say that the issue for us is that we have the A.E. Hodson report, and it does cite that among the information cited there is that was, they did look at those flows. And so the question we had is, well, we would like to see that information to make a judgment about whether that's sufficient and whether we agree with that conclusion, basically. What we don't want to put the water district in a position of is in supplying the water to this to the applicant becoming out of compliance with those requirements. So we would like to see what was reviewed and what was submitted, and we are looking at, and what I would refer you to here is page 9 of that report. The A. Hodson report, which states, this indicates that under conditions of maximum pumpage and low flow in the Goose River, 20% of the river flow could be induced into the aquifer. So we would like to see that explicitly that's been accounted for in that assessment that was done. And there are other issues related to interference between the wells and what the efficiency of the wells would be under certain scenarios that are discussed in that report. And again, that's referred to, but what the evidence for, what the analysis was, is something we want to see basically so that we can verify that in fact that water capacity exists to provide to supply the proposed development.
Jim, again, just this is a side comment. I sat on the board of directors for a water district that was on well supplies for 35 years. And I'd be very hesitant to give you the information. What's public you have access to. But I would be looking back at my engineering company and my people who did the work, and they'd be facing the liability with me for issues that arose based on what they told me I could or couldn't do, especially if I bought a site based on that. So I understand it'd be awful nice to have that information, but I don't know how we can mandate this applicant go to the Belfast Water District and get it unless the Belfast Water District decides they want to provide it. That's my comment.
This is Peggy Bensinger. Just from a legal perspective, and this is an important discussion and an interesting one, I just would let the board know that the board does have the authority to require an applicant or, shall I say, a permittee, if a permit were to be granted to someone and the board wanted to put a condition on such a permit that required something to happen that involved a third party. The board does actually have that authority. Interestingly, there's a case involving the Hannaford Shopping Center in Portland on Forest Avenue when the board issued a site law permit for that shopping center. It conditioned it and said the shopping center couldn't be built unless the city of Portland, I believe it was, changed an intersection next to it. And the applicant appealed that to court and said the board didn't have the authority to require a condition that involved something the applicant or the permittee then had no control over. And the court said the board does have that authority, and if the Hannaford Shopping Center couldn't get the city to do the necessary thing, they couldn't build the project. So the board does have at least the legal authority. It's a different question whether the board would want to do that if it were to decide to issue a permit here. But the board does have the legal authority to require an applicant to supply information that it could only get from a third party.
The board may have the legal authority, but if the water district doesn't want to participate, they still are subject to their ratepayers and that sale of water. That's a revenue source for them. Their compliance with Chapter 587, even if we review their report, are we going to overthrow what their geologists and what their engineers told them and put those people into liability positions for not doing something the way, quote, we want it done? The water district, I think, is a standalone entity. They've come on with a contract and said they can provide 500 gallons a minute. They should be able to put faith in that, because if not, every time they offer to provide water to anyone, they may be subject to the same kind of review. So I understand from a legal point of view, yes, maybe they can do it. From a practical point of view, if I sit on the water district, I wouldn't give it to you.
Okay? I would like to maybe put a pin on that long enough to get our questions to staff, and then I think we should return to that discussion, because I think you raise a very good point. So if you would... I'm going to go to Mr. Pelletier next. If you can mute your mic or give me the pen, one or the other, Mr. Parker.
Fine, no problem.
Mr. Pelletier.
Thanks. I understand Nordic agreed to provide a number of different reports on the different parameters, and that, you know, there's some discussion going on as to how frequently we get the reports, particularly in the early days when everything's just starting up and we're trying to better understand the influence of water intakes. But particularly in terms of saltwater intrusion, I'm wondering which parameters that we're looking for here. Would it be conductivity? And do we have the department's interested in trying to kind of get ahead of it and to look for trends before things happen? Do we have some confidence that we're able to specifically narrow down particular kinds of metrics we're looking for to help identify that potential in advance of it actually happening?
I would say yes. We sort of following the way we would set this up as outlined in those memos and comparable with other monitoring plans, what we would look at would be conductivity and also key parameters such as chloride and bromide, for example, would be collected as far as for background. And then we would not necessarily require monitoring for those chemical parameters on a routine basis, but we'd set our alert levels based on the observed range of conductivity in a pre-development condition. And what we would propose to the board would be ultimately would be something that said, if the conductivity at a particular site, which is a value specific to that site, exceeds this range, that triggers the next level of analysis where we would go to chloride and bromide, say, to say, okay, is this seawater intrusion? And that's a level that's set, again, it's outside of the background status, it's suggestive of seawater intrusion, but it's a level that's set before we see an adverse impact due to that. So that gives the department and the applicant the opportunity to assess the situation and develop an appropriate response.
right now we probably don't have all the information we need to actually do that type of analysis. Is that correct?
That's correct. There was one, we do know that there was one well that did show an increase in conductivity during the pump test. We don't know for it's potentially seawater, although it would be interesting to see that happen during that short duration. So hypothetically, it might also be related to road salt contamination from Route 1. That's an issue we would try to resolve early on in the process, whether during the background phase, hopefully, or at some other point. But certainly that's something we would want to know. But it does suggest that that concern is there. And if we go back to some of the figures in the assessment that was done and the modeling that was done, clearly are predicting significant drawdowns well below sea level in the offshore area. Again, that potential for saltwater intrusion is there. We would determine what the baseline chemistry is, go to just conductivity as an indicator, as a sentinel, if you will, so that if that conductivity exceeds a certain range, we go back to take another snapshot of what the water chemistry is so we can answer questions about, is this road salt contamination, is it seawater contamination, how significant is it, how much does it differ from what we saw in the background condition, and where do we go from there?
That's perfect. Thanks, John.
Thank you. I'm looking for any other questions from board before I launch one or two of my own. And I don't see any, I believe. So let me ask a couple of, I'm trying to understand the regulatory triggers. What we don't want to have happen is that the neighbor's well goes dry. We would like to be able to catch it beforehand. And we're expecting at this point, I think, some kind of monitoring plan. Who reports when there's a problem? Do they just do regular reports and the department reads them and catches it? Or do they report to you, hey, we have a problem here? How would that happen?
The way it normally is set up would be that if everything is staying within the operational parameters, there are reports that come in monthly, quarterly, annually, depends on the development and how things are proceeding there. But they come in at a specified interval, and we would check those to be sure that, in fact, everything is still in accordance with things. They would submit data electronically. We would enter those into our database, into our online database. And if everything proceeds normally, that's how we would operate. The trigger level, the alert level, would be set such that in the course of this normal operation, if the operator sees something that triggers an alert level, they have a specified time within which to notify the department, and there would be an action specified that might be one or more of increasing the frequency of monitoring, increasing the parameter list for monitoring, something like that, that basically is saying this is something's happened, we want to take a closer look at it to understand it. But they would be required if we did do something comparable to the way we do most of our other monitoring programs, if it hits that alert level, they have a specified period of time to notify the department, and they have to take certain actions, which would be essentially taking a closer look at what that trigger is. One of them certainly would be to see if that's a real result, or if it's just an anomalous spike, an equipment malfunction, or a lab error. All those are things we would specify.
Great. If too much water is being taken and the trigger happens, it's not really up to us, the board, or the department to engineer what the applicant would do about it. We would simply say, you're taking too much water, go deal with it. Is that comparable to what happens with other development projects like this? We don't specify how they're going to design things.
We don't, but there can be certain options provided, and exactly comparable to the situation, but to take a significant groundwater well for a water bottling operation. Clearly, you know, if there's an impact on a stream, they have to meet a certain stream flow.
It's up to them how to do it. But they might propose to us a mechanism. In fact, they have proposed to us a mechanism in some cases that essentially is we have an unused well in a completely different part of the property. We've looked at the water quality in the stream and the water quality in that comes out of this well. And if we get a flow below this point, is it acceptable to pump from that well, transfer that water from one watershed to another, basically, and so supplement the flow in that stream? And if the temperature and chemical characteristics of the stream are comparable and we can determine that the use of that well is not going to create an additional problem, that would be an option. The goal for us is to maintain the integrity of that stream, and if that's a way to do it that allows the operator to continue, then that's something we would consider.
It seems like we have pretty good control in what we do with the permit and conditions on monitoring for Little River, because we can require the applicant to do that. But they're also buying water from Belfast, which is essentially certifying, I think, to them and to us that they can provide that much water. Is the condition suggested that maybe we do some monitoring at Goose River, but that doesn't apply to the applicant so much as it does to Belfast, getting to Mr. Parker's point. Is that accurate?
It does, in part simply because we don't know yet. There may be adequate data from the Goose River. That's why we requested that information back in September, so that we could look at that, and it may very well be that does demonstrate that point. But in the absence of that information, or if that information is not adequate to act to demonstrate that, we would look for something more detailed. But in not having that information in hand sort of requires us to start from zero and say, okay, what would we do if we had no information at all, but instead of the situation we're in?
Great. I think Ms. Lessard.
So the information that was provided that was used in 2018, PUC utilized that to say, yes, you can do the sale, yes, you can sell this much water. But there was something that was said earlier on that the PUC, as part of its approval, did not determine something related to environmental in terms of its approval. It said, yeah, it shows there's that much water and you can sell it if you want to, but is that correct? Is the PUC's, I think it was Dawn that talked about it when she first started the discussion, that the PUC approval of the sale and the water didn't address an environmental component. Is that correct?
Yeah, I've read the PUC docket, and it does not address whether there would be any environmental concerns as a result of the sale of the water. And that's why we're here. The PUC didn't take that into consideration. We certainly have the statutes to make sure that, like for instance, the pumping of the Talbot well doesn't cause, you know, an unreasonable dewatering of the Goose River or something along those lines. And it doesn't, you know, my only point in mentioning that is that it does not appear that the PUC did any of that analysis when they made their decision. And so that it should be here.
So that makes it more important that the department, what I would refer this is peer review. And for many of us who do applications, people submit engineering stuff to us all the time, but we don't just say, okay, that's great. We send it out to another set of engineers that the town contracts with for a peer review as to the manner of how it was conducted, whether it's all consistent with that kind of thing. So I'm looking at this kind of as a peer review of whatever was done in 2018 in order to determine if there are the environmental impacts that were not considered by the PUC as part of their determination. Is that?
And John, you can certainly jump in, but it's my understanding that, you know, we've got the 2018 AE Hodgson report But we don't necessarily have all of the data that they used to get to that report, and we've requested some of that data, and it just hasn't been provided yet.
That's correct, yeah. Yeah, the PUC, if we go to the PUC order, it notes that there's no specific contractual curtailment provisions in the water supply agreement during the first 6 years. So that agreement does not, in the PUC's opinion, have a way for the utility to reduce the flow, although the utility indicated that it has a general authority to curtail or reduce water sales in the event of, in the case of a drought or other water supply emergency. But whether that includes maintenance of the environmental flows in the Goose River for the utility to comply with the flow rule is not explicitly not discussed at all in the PUC.
Okay, one other question. The discussion of background data regarding groundwater level and quality that's a potential condition should the board consider issuing this application. How long a process is that? And is that something that could be happening now in preparation for construction? It says that a plan has to be established prior and submitted and approved prior to construction, or would. But what's the time frame for the collection of this background data in terms of this proposal?
We would certainly want there to be as much as practical, so that you could define it, so that we don't get, for example, an unusually wet year or an unusually dry year when we're trying to establish flows or water levels. But one of the unfortunate things is that people aren't out there collecting data for many years in the anticipation that at some point the kind of development is going to come in. So we do have to deal with the interval during which site preparation and construction are taking place, and would have to take that into account and set our parameters with an appropriate degree of conservatism. If based on that we saw that there was not an impact, if we saw that this is a year with normal precipitation, we'll set our error bars at this based on 1 year, and if we continue to see flows or water levels or whatever within that range, then that gives us some more confidence and we can tighten that up a little bit better. But we would, due to the limitations on what we could do with the statistics of each data point, sort of have to set a fairly conservative tolerance limit starting out, particularly if we have unusually wet or dry conditions during the construction phase. The information submitted by the applicant does, in the briefs, does say that they have been doing ongoing monitoring at some locations, so that's certainly helpful in terms of defining those parameters better.
Thank you very much.
Looking to see if there's questions from staff. Ms. Bertacci, do you have something?
Just to follow up on that conversation, I'm wondering if a permit were to issue, how a condition would work. Would it be approving the withdrawal up to the amounts that have been requested by the applicant with some sort of a reopener provision if, in fact, monitoring showed that there were problems with the withdrawal that was actually taking place and the drawdown of the aquifers? Just how might that work?
That would be comparable to how we've done the other significant groundwater well permits, that there's an allowed maximum amount or per year or per month or however it's set up, provided that the following performance standards are met. And if the performance standards are not met, one remedy certainly is for the operator to reduce that water usage until they are met.
And just to follow up to that, I mean, would the department have the ability to require that they use less water? If we've approved the permit for withdrawal up to a certain amount, and the data is indicating that there's potentially the aquifer cannot support it, you know, cannot sustain that level of withdrawal, does the department have the ability to come in and modify the application? Just how would that work?
Also, we do have a request about Mr. Hopek. We have a request that you get closer to the mic or speak up a little more.
Okay. Hopefully that's a little better.
Much better.
Okay. I would say to get to Ms. Bertacci's question, that again is comparable to how we do it. The applicant has to meet, the operator has to meet the environmental standards. To some extent, it's up to them how they do it. That if they, to go back to sort of the example we talked about before, a water bottler needs or wants to produce so many gallons per month. The way these things work, that the time they want to do most of, they're doing a lot of their bottling is toward the drier part of the year. The goal we have is to say that stream flows or hydraulic gradients into a wetland or whatever have to be maintained. If you can maintain those by supplying that water from another source that is environmentally acceptable, then you can do that. If you can maintain that by reducing production at a well in part of your site and increasing production in a well in another part of the site, you can do that. That's up to the operator. The condition for us is that there is a trigger that kicks in that says at this point the operator has to tell the department what they're going to do to meet the relevant standard in the permit.
Thank you.
In the absence of data from
Someone's audio dropped out there. I didn't catch that question.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Let's say that we don't have City of Belfast data or the studies or any monitoring in place. How do we know when they've taken so much water out of their aquifer that Goose River is suffering?
In the absence of that information, we would not be able to make that determination.
Okay, so an alternative would be if the applicant is not getting enough water from Belfast for whatever reason, then we can dictate or we can have some plan that would restrict our operations accordingly until the water renews. Is that accurate?
That would be an approach, yeah. And again, we would hopefully design working with an applicant to design something that. The issue we always want to resolve is we don't want to have a catastrophic event where suddenly something happens and everybody has to scramble. If there is an issue with water supply from one place, we want certainly the affected parties, all of the affected parties, to be able to respond to it in a reasonable manner that causes the least disruption. Well, certainly for the individual homeowners, but for the operator also, it's like, I'm having a problem here. I it's not like I have to suddenly find some place to put all these fish. I have time to adjust my production schedule to account for potentially a smaller amount of water coming from the source.
Thank you. What I'm trying to get at ultimately is, if things go wrong, who's got the problem? And right now, in the absence of monitoring or the data from Belfast, if they're not delivering enough water or they're causing impacts we don't know about, that's a tough nut to crack. If there's simply not enough water that was requested in the plan from the applicant, then the applicant seems to have the problem, which probably is going to require some cutting back or a different source of water, taking more seawater, whatever it is. So I'm just trying to understand who's got the problem when things go wrong, if they do. Anything else from the board for questions or from staff?
Yeah, Bob, I got one more question for Kevin, just following up on the water supply. Do you have the ability to determine what impact the initial well with a 500-gallon capacity draw would have on that stream without actually physically installing a well and pumping it. That's for Kevin, if he's still there.
Kevin who? John Hopek. John Hopek.
Yeah. Possibly. I mean, they certainly the Hodgson report indicates that pumping was done, but at what rates, for how long, what effects they saw, that's information we don't have. But certainly one thing you could do, I mean, they do project out certain percentage losses of the river flow under various scenarios. So that's information we want to see and where and how those were measured. Once you have that set up, and certainly what we would want the operator to do for the Little River is to have something and flow is tricky to measure, but you can calibrate a section of the river so that you know from the depth of water, essentially, what the flow is within a reasonable amount. So that may have been done at the Goose River. We simply don't know. Hopefully it was. It's how USGS would do it, and many other people would do it. It's how we've done it in the past. So that may be an appropriate measure. And once you have that, then you can make inferences as to the behavior of the river. But at the moment, we don't know that.
Yeah, sorry about that. I seem to recall from the hearing that one of the reasons they're taking water from Belfast is that's part of the agreement for building there in the first place. They'd have maybe enough water through other sources, even if it's seawater, but it's a financial agreement with Belfast that they're going to buy this much water so that Belfast gets that much money. Does anyone else remember it that way?
Yes.
Yeah, so okay.
Yes, that's
so
right.
It's not necessarily a matter that we need all this water from all these sources. It's that we agreed to buy this much water that we're trying to work our way around now. Ms. Lessard.
I think at the hearing I asked that question about how much water do you need to run this? How much water? And the answer, if I remember correctly, was what's in the permit request. That's what we need. Because that was my point. Is this how much it's going to take to actually operate this totally built-up facility? Or is this just the capacity of the sources to have water drawn from them safely in two things, and by a purchase agreement in the third, which are completely different numbers than the amount of water necessary to operate this facility? That question is still floating around in my brain, which is how much is necessary to operate the facility when it's totally built out of each of these sources, instead of what is the highest limit that two of these can stand, and the third is a contractual agreement. That's still a question, because I did ask the question that several times, but the issue is if all of this is going to be used all the time, which is what I'm going on, because that's what I was told, we need all of it, then it would be really essential that every piece of this is well researched in terms of environmental impact and capacity. Is that, I would assume that's why the department as well is making sure that each of these three components can be used to the maximum without impact to some other entity. Is that correct, Mr. Hopek?
I would say that sums it up. That what we have on the table is a proposal to take up to 500 gallons per minute from the utility, and there are other amounts from other sources. So if that's what's requested, we operate under the assumption that that's what the applicant needs. If they if they were to say, well, we have an agreement that requires us to pay the utility for this, but we really are only going to take some other amount, then we can incorporate that into our analysis. But all we have on the table at the moment is something that says we will take up to 500 gallons per minute. And so we have to assume that's what they're going to do.
Ms. Benziger.
I am curious as to whether the staff knows if the record contains any information about how much just phase one would require for water usage. I don't recall hearing that or seeing that. And I'm just thinking out loud, if the board were to want to go in the direction of issuing a permit, a possible condition could be that the Belfast Water District water could not be used, or only a certain amount of it could be used unless and until the information that Mr. Hopek had requested was provided, and could demonstrate that the full amount from the Belfast Water District would not have an unreasonable environmental impact. I'm just wondering if there's a few year delay, if a permit were issued and there was a few year delay before phase two was operational, that might allow some time for that information to be provided and assessed.
I don't recall, this is Dawn Hollowone, I don't recall seeing a lower demand in the application for just, or having the water usage split out between phase one and phase two. I'm sure that's an option. It could just be that I'm on the spot and I don't remember the record.
Honestly, I'm not even sure that it is an option. If I recall correctly, they have an agreement with Belfast that we're going to buy this much water and here's your money.
Right. The agreement with Belfast, they pay the money whether they use the water or not. They've said very clearly in the hearing that it's not their preference to use the water district water to grow the fish. So, mm-hmm. And that their proposed system has enough flexibility in it to move, you know, draw from different parts of their plan should there be an impact, or, you know, if something happens, they have the ability to be flexible with their water use. And they've even said they could potentially draw more seawater in the mix than fresh water. So they've indicated that they can be adaptable. It's my understanding we don't have all the details ironed out as to how we guide that. And again, John, if you have anything you want to say.
I am looking through the text of the application on another screen here right now, and I am not, it may be there, but I am not seeing something that breaks out water usage by phase one and phase two.
Ms. Lessard, you have a question?
Well, that was my question. He's looking it up, but I don't remember any calculations or seeing anything as part of the record that quantified use in terms of an actual calculation that says we've got this many tanks, they contain this much water, they refresh at a rate of Y criteria, which is the way you back into the number, but without that information, it can't back into the number either. So then you're left with the request for the highest amount that the two of the entities can sustain, and the third is a contractual purchase piece. So I guess the question is there any of that, are there any of those calculations if shown in the application or in information you've seen that talks about the actual X times Y times E, the math that comes that backs up the request for the water?
Not that I'm aware of. John, were you provided any of that data?
I am not finding it as broken out that cleanly. I recall it having been discussed that particularly in early parts of the operation when they were dealing with smaller fish, they would have a lower, and not in production, they would have a lower water use. But I don't remember seeing, and I'm not finding here, a table that breaks it out by the years after start of operation to percentage of full water use or something like anything comparable to that.
But if we were going to be at 50% of operations, it would stand to reason that you would be somewhere in that same vicinity for water use. Unless, I don't know why it would be 80% at 50% of operation, since what you're adding that uses water are tanks and fish. So
I would think that the size of the fish and whether or not you're processing them as to fish to make fillets, basically, those would be important components of water usage. But we would have the applicant is in a better position to weigh in on exactly what that usage would be than we are.
Okay.
Mr. Graber, I believe you have a question or comment.
Well, yeah. And I hate to belabor this point, but I'm still struggling a little bit with our scope of review as it relates to this Goose River issue. And I'm trying to formulate a question, and I think I've got one rather than a statement. And the question I would have for the department staff is, let's take this particular applicant out of the picture for a second and say there was going to be a significant residential subdivision developed within Belfast, and Belfast Water District has agreed to provide the water to this subdivision as they would as a municipal water supplier. What is the department's role in assessing the environmental impact of that? Is that a standard part of the process when a water district says we're going to develop this water supply? What is the typical department's role in that? Outside of a major aquaculture facility like we're talking about now.
Well, certainly verifying that there's sufficient water supply for the proposed development is one of the criteria of site law. So we do approach that. If it's a water utility, in many cases, so we do see water subdivisions that are supplied by water utilities. Typically, the large subdivisions that we see in Maine are a lot smaller than the large subdivisions that are in other parts of the country. So we're looking at much more on the order of a few thousand gallons per day rather than 500 gallons per minute. So in a case like that, where a water utility were to say, we have the capacity to supply an additional 5,000 gallons per day for this development, we would look at that and say, yeah, that seems a reasonable number with what we'd anticipate. That comes down to only so many, some number of cubic feet per second. It seems like in the worst case scenario, it would be able to support that. The issue here is simply, it comes down to two things: the volume of water that they are proposing to look at, and the information that we have been provided by the applicant that says under these scenarios, this will reduce flow in the river by 20%. So that raises the question for us of, okay, what does that mean in terms of the environmental flows? And that's the question we're trying to resolve in this case because of the volume of water proposed.
is so much greater than you would have for a residential subdivision. If you would figure out, you know, you're typically talking for a residential subdivision, the plumbing code numbers give you, depending on the size of the house, 300 to 400 gallons per day. That's a very conservative number since you don't want to design a wastewater disposal system around the median value. You want to design it around a potentially very high value. The actual number would, in most cases, be substantially less than that. So if you are, you know, for 20 houses, you're talking about maybe 5,000 to 6,000 gallons to 5,000 to 8,000 gallons per day. That's a fraction of a cubic foot per second. In this case, we're talking about 500 gallons per minute, which is a substantially greater volume. And so we would scale it to what the proposed use is.
I would address that question briefly. In the site law, the board and the department are authorized or required to assess whether the developer has made adequate provision for fitting the development harmoniously into the natural environment, and that the development will not adversely affect, it goes on, other natural resources in the municipality or in neighboring municipalities, so that the impacts of a proposed development can be looked at in a fairly broad scope. And in looking at Chapter 375, which is the board's regulations that interpret the site law, when the board is looking at whether a proposed development will have an unreasonable adverse effect on groundwater quantity. So obviously it can have some effect on groundwater quantity, but it can't be unreasonable. The board is authorized to look at whether the quantity of water to be taken from groundwater sources will substantially lower the water table, the found water table, cause saltwater intrusion, cause undesirable changes in groundwater flow patterns, or cause unacceptable ground subsidence. So the board has fairly broad authority in looking at potential impacts. I see the concern. How far do you look? Do you look at indirect impacts? But I think the board would have that authority here to look at what is in some ways an indirect impact, because it's actually the water district that's pumping the water for the proposed development.
Thank you.
Mr. Draper, did you have anything else? No? Okay. Ms. Lessard.
So the fact of the matter is we could have just spent the last 45 minutes discussing something that, if you saw the data behind it, could answer the questions that you have in terms of the sufficiency of testing or the sufficiency of what was considered as part of it. And so the concern isn't whether it was done, it was what was done, and having documentation of that to ensure that this 500 gallon per minute, which is a very large rate, has an environmental component that PUC wouldn't have considered. But just having that data would allow, it may make this whole discussion moot. Is that possible?
It's possible. It may, or at least may clarify the issue to the point where we could say, well, if 500 gallons per minute is kind of pushing it, we think that 400 gallons per minute is sustainable in the absence of additional study.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Well, Mr. Barker, I hear your pen. Yep, that pen.
Bob?
Yes, you're on.
Tim again. Another question that I think has to be looked at up front too is, we're not given any numbers on how much water the water district currently pumps and is capable of pumping. And is this well going to be for a backup or a standby in the event they have an issue? Can they produce this water? Al was saying they want to drill another well, probably for redundancy. They may not have to actually drill another well unless they have an emergency situation. And in the agreements with Nordic, if the water company has a problem, Nordic has agreed to stop taking water till they resolve it. So the question is this not, may not be an additional 500 gallons they're going to be have to provide for. It may be already in their aquifer. We don't have any numbers on how much water they actually do pump, how much they can pump, and what their capacity is. And for them to say they may need an additional well, they may want it for redundancy because they got fire flows and other things to be concerned about, not just providing domestic water. And I would assume in Al's paperwork that you may have now, they might already talk about how much they can pump a day and how much they do pump a day. If not, that should be readily available. Thank you.
You're welcome. I see no questions from the board, and I see staff not willing to jump in quickly on that last comment.
Good question.
Ms. Bertacci.
Yes, we've been talking about the Goose River Aquifer, but I'd like to go back to the on-site production wells for just a moment. And I know that Dr. Hopek is interested in obtaining additional background information as to what would be happening with that aquifer. My question is, what level of comfort do we have that that aquifer can produce the requested amount of water for the proposed facility without running into problems of sustainability?
In essence, that's the issue for the monitoring program. Because we've talked about what the modeling exercise and what the pump tests have shown, that sort of the physics is there, that it appears from those that you can move that much water through the system. What the intent of the monitoring program is to assess what the potential impact from that would be. We know from the information supplied by the applicant that we're looking at substantial long-term drawdown in the area in part because we have a thick clay overburden that restricts the amount of recharge that can take place immediately in the area of those wells. So in essence, what has to happen is the wells have to reach out much further to draw that water. So we see numbers looking at Figure 14A in the Appendix 15A of the report, looking at drawdowns of over 100 feet under the reservoir in the intertidal zone, in the area of some of their wells, drawdowns of the order of 10 to 20 feet or more, where in many of the areas of the domestic wells. So the intent of the monitoring program is to really get at that we are seeing that substantial drawdown in the area of these wells and in the areas where saltwater intrusion could be induced. That level of drawdown creates that possibility. Whether that actually takes place, there are a great many municipalities along the Atlantic coast and the Gulf coast that operate and have operated for years water supply wells that are inducing drawdowns of over 100 feet in the offshore area, and they have not experienced saltwater intrusion just because of the nature of the intervening material. On the other hand, there are many localities that have experienced significant subsidence and saltwater intrusion. So at the moment, in the absence of long-term operation of this, we can see from the results that there is the potential for that. But the intent of the monitoring program is to set up a trigger that says if that's starting to happen, and
given the bedrock in this area, subsidence is probably not a major issue. But if we're seeing saltwater intrusion, we want to know early enough that we can prevent or limit the impact of that.
It seems like we've been down this road before. And I guess the troubling thing is nobody can take so much water that they're impacting additional uses or other traditional uses outside of their area, or you're in violation of the Clean Water Act, probably the Natural Resources Protection Act, et cetera. But we have a difficult time, it seems, monitoring when a public utility does that. And we're questioning whether we can assess any impacts before it's too late that Belfast might be doing. But it must have been 8-10 years ago, there were a lot of battles over bottled water withdrawal from public utilities. And so some of this fight has happened before. How was any of that resolved, or was it?
It's resolved. There are simply some developments we don't have jurisdiction over. The most conspicuous, I guess, is Freiburg, in which the water utility, I don't want to mischaracterize the arrangement because I don't know it well enough to be able to characterize it accurately. Sure, is that better?
Yes, much better.
Nestle Waters and the Freiburg Water District have a relationship that allows, in essence, I'm oversimplifying, but that Nestle Waters buys a substantial amount of water from the water district. And it's simply we have no jurisdiction over that other than assisting the Department of Health and Human Services in the bulk water transport review. Other cases, it sort of falls to what level of review we have. We have, because certain, I was talking to someone the other day, a blueberry processing facility. If it's an irrigation well, then that's an agricultural use and we don't have jurisdiction, although we do work with LUPC and the Maine Geological Survey to assist them in review of it to bring up what are the relevant issues. But if it is a washing facility that's more an industrial use, that's a case where if that facility triggers site law, we would look at that well under the criteria for site law. So going far afield, but I don't think you could say that there's a uniform approach, although the agencies do work cooperatively to the extent we can to try to provide consistent review.
Well, I recall battles over low-flow stream rules, and especially with blueberry growers who needed a lot of water, in areas where Atlantic salmon was hopefully going to be restored. So again, we've had some of these battles, and I'm not sure what jurisdiction we have when a stream is being drawn down to the point where you can no longer swim it or fish it. If a municipality or a utility is doing that, the department has no jurisdiction?
I turn to Ms. Benjamin for that answer.
Your mic on?
There are rules that apply to water withdrawals that would impact streams, and perhaps we can postpone that discussion to the water discussion later. But certainly, I think in the context of this site law permit application, the department has the jurisdiction to look at impacts of the proposed usage of both surface water and groundwater. And as I said before, I think that ability to look at those impacts, both direct and indirect, is fairly broad. And on another slightly different topic, I just wanted to, there was some discussion at the hearing, and I'm trying to remember exactly what it was about, the replacement of wells that might be impacted by either saltwater intrusion or drawdown. And I think there was testimony, and the staff can maybe speak to that, about offers or agreements that are in the record by the applicant to provide alternate water supplies if a permit is issued and if those impacts were to occur. But if the board were to consider issuing a permit, Chapter 375 actually enunciates that as a potential condition. It says the department may, as a term or condition of approval, establish any reasonable requirement to ensure that there will be no unreasonable adverse effect on groundwater quantity, such as requiring that people in a surrounding area whose wells are adversely affected by the development be provided with new wells or another source of potable water for their use and consumption. So that there was some comment on that earlier. I just wanted to address that.
Any further questions or comment from the board? Then I'll entertain a little discussion among the board about your feelings, positive and negative, on what you heard so far. But any further questions? All right. For purposes of discussion, how do you feel about what you heard? Well, thank you all for coming. yes, and Ms. Lessard.
I personally think that the request of the department for information that can help to determine long-term impact is reasonable. And however that is couched in terms of whether it's through a permit and a condition of that permit, or it's not a permit until somebody comes up with that information because it can't be processed, I think that answering those questions is important to one of the most fundamental aspects of this application, just because of its very high water usage.
Mr. Pelletier?
I thought that the potential conditions that were listed by the staff were appropriate, and all things that they're looking to ask. Peggy's suggestion that maybe we look at a way of helping to light that fire, of getting that information by putting a maybe a phased condition on this thing might be a way to help make sure we get that. I thought that was a good suggestion, though.
Yeah, I think my own feeling on the subject is I hate to condition anything for an applicant that they have no control over. How the Belfast Water District deals with taking too much water out of its system that can't even be monitored or reported to the department is not something the applicant has a whole lot of control over. I think there may be some interest within the city of Belfast government for visiting the issue, and they're certainly welcome to do that. In the meantime, I think we're in the position of having to consider what do we write in the conditions so that the environment is not unreasonably impacted by too much water withdrawal from that third party, the Belfast Water District. That looks like it's going to have to be a condition for us to have any kind of comfort. The only other thing we can condition is what steps does the applicant have to take if they don't have enough water? And I really don't want to engineer business decisions for somebody. All right, if there's no further discussion, probably the department has heard quite a bit on the subject at this point, and there'll be sure internal additional discussions. Anything else from in this room? Nope. We have approached noon. Let me get Ms. Bertacci on the line here, and we can talk timetable.
Well, I think it's just a time to break for lunch. I don't, and then we can pick up on land afterwards, the two other major topics, and then there were a number of additional topics board members might want to comment on. So I'm not sure a half an hour might be sufficient, or do folks need a little more time than that? And I guess I would ask board members.